Okay, we're gonna start on revenue. Hello, Norwalk. Welcome. Really reasonable hour back there. Okay, we're gonna start with revenue.
Thanks, Russ. So we have three topics today that we're bringing back to the board. It's largely based on feedback we received from our drafting process, both from external reviewers as well as some board member comments that we thought was important to discuss with you again. So there's three papers, A, B, and C. We're going to slightly change the order just based on the education sessions that we've had. So we're going to start on A, as probably expected, which is the collectability paper, and then we're going to move to paper C, which talks about the constraint and minimums, and then we'll come back and talk about paper C, which was about paragraph 14, when you might fail the model, what you should do. So A, then C, then B. Okay, with that, I'll let Glenn go ahead and take off on paper A.
Oh, thanks, Kristen, and good morning, everyone. So paper 7A, 173A, deals with collectability or accounting for customer credit risk. And the primary focus of this paper is how assessments of customer credit risk should be reflected in accounting for contracts with customers. Principally, we are talking about contracts with customers without a significant financing component. We also have an addendum to that paper, which has been distributed, and I'll talk about that as well in this tier. So as a quick bit of background, in the paper, we sort of refer in paragraph 5 to the core principle of the revenue model, and that's based on recognising revenue at the entitled amount, the amount of consideration the entity expects to be entitled in exchange for goods or services which are provided to the customer. In November last year, in September and November last year, we discussed collectability with the boards. And the board's decision was really to reaffirm that revenue is recognised at the entitled amount, and that would show any impairments associated with those contracts with customers as an expense, so below the line, but for that to be presented prominently. And that was a change from the 2011 ED, where we had said impairments relating to revenue from contracts with customers should be presented adjacent to the revenue line. We also provided some additional clarifications in paragraph 14 about existence of a contract, which sort of required you to make an initial assessment as to whether there was commercial substance to the contract and whether the parties were committed to the contract. And we had talked at that time about circumstances where perhaps a customer may not have commitment or intention to perform under the contract if there was significant doubt about collectability with the customer. So we have, during the sort of the various versions of the draft standard which we've been preparing, we have sort of tried to reflect those decisions in the draft. We've also tried to, I think, further clarify, based on some comments we received, how to assess whether or not in a contract with a customer, where there is some uncertainty about customer credit risk, but where there is a valid contract, whether that uncertainty about customer credit risk should be accounted for as an impairment, or whether it should be accounted for as indicative that the entity intends to offer a price concession, i.e. that there is an implicit price concession in that contract. So we've talked about that in the paper, I think around paragraphs 8 through to about 15, which sort of explain, and also in Appendix A of the paper, which sort of explain various paragraphs where we've addressed that. That includes paragraphs 14, 50, 52.1, 53.1 of the draft standard. In terms of feedback we got from those drafts, they did note that there was a little bit of concern about some apparent overlap in some of the guidance, where there is concerns about customer credit risk, particularly whether those concerns about customer credit risk would lead you to question whether or not you have a contract with a customer, i.e. whether or not paragraph 14 is passed or failed, or whether you should take into account those uncertainties about customer credit risk as a suggesting there is an implicit price concession. And so I think in the paper we do sort of suggest some sort of minor revisions, clarifications that can sort of address some of that confusion. And we have asked a question on that, but I might sort of just not mention that to you at this point in time, but rather go on to what I think was the main piece of feedback we received, and perhaps we can start the discussion there. And the main piece of feedback we received is, as a consequence of making those clarifications about how to assess whether or not customer credit risk is indicative of there being an implicit price concession or there an impairment, people actually said they read the draft and they were confused. They didn't know how best to make that assessment. And there were concerns that you might lead to divergence in how different people might sort of interpret those requirements. As a consequence, we've developed some alternatives that might provide a way in which provides greater guidance or clarity as to how you assess whether customer credit risk affects assessment of whether there's an implicit price concession, which means the consideration is variable and you would need to estimate it and apply the constraints, or whether it's an impairment event, in which case you recognise revenue at the entitled amount being the stated contract price, and you'd show your expectations of collectability as an impairment expense below the line. So the first alternative, alternative A, really sort of suggests some clarification that we could add to the standard to give a bit more of a framework for making an assessment as to whether or not customer credit risk should be dealt with as a price concession or as an impairment. And that includes things like providing a bit more of explanation about the distinction, requiring an entity to consider various facts and circumstances as to whether consideration is variable, identifying some attributes where price concessions are more likely to be provided, or assessing other evidence, such as whether an entity has undertaken genuine attempts to enforce their rights to payment, or whether or not the entity has previously agreed to partial payment as full payment or full settlement of the debt. So alternative A, that's one approach. Alternative B would sort of acknowledges that judgment is required in assessing whether or not you've offered a price concession or an impairment. And perhaps to reduce the tension associated with that distinction, we could go back to the 2011 ED approach, which would say recognise revenue at the gross amount, present adjacent to the revenue line your impairment loss, determined in accordance with the impairment standards. And importantly, under alternative B, we would say that the impairment loss would be a component of revenue. So that means there would be a subtotal, so you'd have revenue, less impairment losses, subtotal, and that subtotal would be revenue. Now, that is an approach which obviously we proposed in the 2011 ED, although we didn't clarify in the 2011 ED whether that subtotal would be revenue. But we also note in existing US GAAP, timeshares and healthcare have a similar approach to dealing with customer credit risk in those cases. A third approach, and this is presented in the addendum, is alternative C. And what that would say is perhaps one way we can reduce a bit of the uncertainty associated or the judgment required in determining whether or not the customer credit risk is in price concession or impairment would be to say, if an entity enters into a contract with a customer knowing that the customer is a significant credit risk, you are deemed to have offered an implicit price concession in that contract. As a consequence, you have promised variable consideration in the contract, and you would have to estimate it and apply the constraint. An important thing, and this is sort of noted on the first page of the addendum, an important thing with alternative C is that any subsequent reassessments about sort of collectability, customer credit risk, would flow through the revenue line. So the impairment model would not apply to this subset of contracts with significant credit risk. And that is a difference between alternative A, where alternative A requires some judgment as to whether or not it's a price concession or impairment. Each time you make a reassessment, under alternative C, it's absolute. Every time, every reassessment, that's deemed to be sort of a reassessment of the variable consideration that runs through the revenue line.
That's up or down, Glenn, right?
Up or down. We have some examples of how that works on perhaps the third page of that addendum. I'll only briefly just mention example four, so just to illustrate the distinction. So in example four, the basic facts are the customer has assessed as being of high credit risk. The contract doesn't give any indication that a price concession will be offered. But because of the high credit risk, the entity sort of expects that they will only collect 60 out of the $100 stated contract price. So under alternative A and really alternative B, the entity's got to make a decision. What am I intending to do? Have I offered an implicit price concession? Or am I seeking to enforce the stated contract price? And you know, if I can't collect that, I'm going to impair it, have a bad debt write-off. In this example, we, the staff, have just assumed, for the purpose of the illustration, that the entity has decided it's an impairment. So they would recognise revenue gross at the 100 amount and then show the impairment separately at the 40. Now, the distinction between A and B is that in A, the impairment is presented as another expense, so revenue is 100. In B, the impairment is presented adjacent to revenue, and so therefore you've got this net revenue line and revenue is 60. With alternative C, we are removing that judgment that is required. Because the entity entered into a contract which at inception they identified the customer was a significant credit risk, they are deemed to have offered an implicit price concession in that contract. Therefore, revenue would be a variable amount recognised at the amount they expect to collect, which would be 60. Importantly, that amount could be zero because the constraint would apply, and if in applying the constraint, the entity had determined there was a risk of a significant revenue reversal, that revenue could be recognised at nil at the time of transfer, and only subsequently, when the uncertainty is resolved, would revenue be recognised. We have also noted, I'll just mention this quickly, there would be some, we think, some possible implications with some of these alternatives, particularly C, and we've noted some of those implications in paragraphs, or in pages 4 and 5 of the handout. With that, Russ, I might sort of hand it back to you. The last question in the paper is probably the question we'd suggest sort of the boards consider first, which is, of those alternatives, A, B, or C, which would they prefer?
Can I ask a question? On example 4, alternative A, why is revenue 100 and not 60? When the memo on paragraph 32 talks about if there's significant credit risk, you have to consider variable consideration. Why in the example there's significant credit risk, you didn't consider it to be variable consideration in example 4?
I think with example 4, we just concluded that a judgment, what we were trying to illustrate was that a judgment would need to be made, and we just fell on the side in this case that the judgment would be made that it's an impairment.
So there could have been a judgment in that scenario that was the same as C.
Absolutely. But what's open to question in A is that judgment needs to be made. And in C, that judgment does not need to be made.
And could it have been zero as well in A?
Yes, so if you assessed it with an implicit price concession, it's variable consideration, the constraint could apply, and it could be zero.
Philippe?
Well, it seems to me that in this proposal, you are replacing one judgment, whether it is impairment or price reduction, with another one, whether the customer is so high credit risk that you have to apply this alternative. And unless we provide very detailed guidance on the level of credit risk beyond which you apply this alternative, people will have to make a judgment anyway. It seems to me that if we apply properly the criteria in paragraph 14 as to whether you have a bona fide contract or not, that should solve the issue. In my opinion, when you have such a high credit risk, you cannot say I meet all the criteria in paragraph 14. Hence, I have to book an amount which is what I expect to be entitled to. And forgetting the nominal amount, which you know you will never collect. It's your decision to accept it. So I must say, I would rather rely on paragraph 14, maybe strengthened a little bit, to deal with those very unique issues where you deal on a basis which you know is different from your theoretical contractual practice. We know that alternative B has been rejected by all our constituents. They say, no, we want to see the revenue and we want to see the impairment separately, or the price reduction separately, if it is the price reduction. So alternative C, yes, could be okay as an alternative to the paragraph 14, but only for those very, very rare situations where you know you are not dealing with a customer on the basis which is a theoretical contract price, but you are dealing on another basis and you accept it from day one. So you have a contract for a different amount from the amount which is theoretical price. But my preference is really to stay with alternative A and to strengthen paragraph 14 to make it really operational so that we screen out those contracts which are purely artificial in terms of the price.
Larry?
I have a couple questions, actually. First of all, in the specific example, why is revenue allowed if this is deemed to be a price concession that throws you into the variable model? This is point in time, so you don't think you're going to collect the 100. So at the end of the day, I think there's significant concerns about revenue reversal, and I would think that you have zero under the model that we have. And I'm not saying that I support that model, but so why is it 60 and not zero?
Expected value.
Well, we've made some assumptions in this example as well, saying that they've deemed it to be variable consideration. They're going to offer a price concession. They have evidence that they have estimated it to be 60. So they've gone through paragraph 55, come up with their estimate, it's 60, and they've gone through then the constraint and suggested that that 60 they can support, there would not be a significant reversal.
So when you apply the point in time to the constraint model, you don't consider your contractual amount, but the amount that you originally estimated.
Because we've deemed this to be a variable consideration and a price concession.
That's right.
Yes.
Okay, that's number one. Number two, in your description of the different examples, under example four, this is at the bottom of page 2 of 6, it says the customer has high credit risk and there is no contractual requirement to provide price concessions. And I was trying to evaluate alternative A versus alternative C. And quite frankly, I find it pretty difficult to imagine that there are going to be contracts that embed in it specific instances where you're going to grant price concessions because of your perception that a customer is not going to be able to pay. I mean, I think it's non-existent. So I really have a difficult time because I don't think that consideration will be in contracts, period. I mean, I just find it hard to believe.
Self-defeating. So.
You done? Wegu?
On question 1, 2, and 3, let's start, you know, the question 1, I will not keep, you know, 14E at all, because I feel we confuse ourselves.
Yeah, I think they wanted to do they want to do that in a few minutes. Right now they want to just A, B, and C, and once we get that, then we'll do
A, B, and C. I will prefer B, because the problem is, you know, we start with expected, and then we change to entitled. Then we have problems whether there is possibilities, you know, the two sides or one side want to pop up there, the revenues. So I think, in my view, the best way is B. But we already changed our decision. And that is, we will not present the impairment adjacent to the revenue lines. We already made decision. Unless we re-debate again and again. If we want re-debate, I would like B too. Exactly. But since we already decided, so I will accept A. I think it's okay. But I think we should enhance disclosure, because when we discuss in Norwalk, I remember about maybe 3 years ago, about adjacent, we already touched the possibilities the second line include impairment, you know, price concession, discount. And sometimes it's hard to distinguish. Sometimes it's easier to distinguish. Then you should try to disclose and let users know. So back to the questions. Now I can accept A.
Mark?
Don't give up on B. We are redebating the issue. That's what the meeting is.
No,
we're redebating the issue.
No, because they won't finish the project, you know.
I have a question.
Howard PK.
I have a question about alternative C, and because the addendum came out after our education session, so forgive me. But the how is C different from a sentence that we have already in the staff draft? 53.1b, actually it's one that you're trying, you're suggesting that we remove. The last sentence of 53.1b in the staff draft says, for example, entering into a contract with a customer when there is significant doubt about the collectability of the amount of promised consideration indicates that the entity may intend to provide a price concession. So isn't alternative C just basically keeping that language?
In many respects, yes, but part of the problem and the reason why we're proposing to delete that sentence from 53.1b is a couple of paragraphs above. Of course, I can't find it when I'm looking
for it. No, it's 52.
Yeah, 52.1, where we say, however, if the contract has a significant... Oh, sorry, no, it's the first sentence.
No, I know. I know there's a conflict between those two.
We've got the conflict, which in 52.1 says the transaction price will not be adjusted for the effects of customer credit risk.
But alternative C is basically...
That's right. So what we're proposing is to delete that sentence from 53.1B because of that just jarring conflict that people are seeing when they read it. Instead, what we would do is provide some additional clarification about how you make this distinction between price concession versus impairment. Alternative C would be built around a concept like what we've got in this last sentence in 53.1b, but it would be presented as, you know, if you have a contract with a customer with a significant credit component, you are deemed to have your amount of entitled consideration needs to reflect the fact that you have offered a price concession, therefore it is variable consideration.
That just seems I was just trying to clarify, because it seems to me that a way to implement alternative C is just to keep the sentence in 53.1 and delete the offending sentence in 52.
I think that the problem with 53.1b is that people thought it applied to all contracts. So even sort of a very typical contract where you just have sort of 1 or 2% of credit risk, and I think that was some of the difficulty, whereas C will sort of put in kind of a gatekeeper. So it says, you know, only in contracts where there's significant credit risk do you think about this. So it's just defining it so that it's clear that it only applies in some cases.
I think, Mark, that to a large extent, C, what we're talking about here is not necessarily going to be dramatically different from what we've got here, but we need to draft it better. So that's one thing, so it's clearer. The second thing is C would say you are deemed that it is a price concession, whereas in 53.1B, we say the existence of significant doubt about collectability indicates that you might provide a price concession, so it's not deemed.
Okay.
So in some respects, you might say 53.1B is also similar to A, alternative A.
Yeah.
Well, that's kind of what I was getting at. Alternative C, you know, it jumps out as something that's strikingly different, but I don't think it is. It's actually something that's already kind of in there.
Yeah.
So, that's all.
Tom?
The staff didn't give us a recommendation. Do you have a recommendation after thinking about this in terms of A, B, or C? And it seems to me, if it's C, there are some knock-on decisions that might make us have to think about some of the A issues and the B issues anyhow. Are you going to defer a recommendation, or could, in terms of dealing with this issue, it seems to me C does an effective job in dealing with the big problem, contracts. But it also seems to me that if C is selected, and I'm tending to lean towards that, that presentation of impairment should be adjacent. Because what happens in C is when you have financing with a significant, a contract with a significant financing component, the impairment's built into the revenue number. When you have a contract with significant credit risk, the impairment's built into the revenue number. So when you don't have significant impairment or financing components, why would we have impairment in a different place? Why not bring it up to be like where the embedded impairment is under the big problems? It seems to me that we would be more consistent that way, my view, and I'd like a reaction to that.
Could I just respond to that, Tom? I mean, if he just always had one sort of contract and it was significant finance risk, I could take your point. But the fact is, if you're going to have a number of whole different contracts, if you go to paragraph 44 of the paper, most often these respondents disagree, so they're disagreeing with B, because they believe that the proximity of the effect of customer credit risk to the revenue line item would inappropriately imply that the entirety of the impairment expense relates to the revenue recognized in the current period. And that impairment expense can be a whole mixture of a whole lot of things. Be last year's contracts that didn't get paid, or 5 years ago contracts that didn't get paid. So you can't make an assumption that it's just negative revenue.
But we are making that assumption in two contracts where credit's most important at the start.
Yeah.
When it's a significant financing component and when there's significant credit risk.
Yeah, but my point
is...
But
then deterioration from that point forwards in a separate line, we're splitting the impairment numbers into multiple places. Why does it make sense to do that?
Well, I don't think we are. I think they should all be down below the line.
They're not. In a significant financing component contract, it's built into the discount rate. The expectation is built in the discount rate, and it's in revenue from day one, the expectation.
What?
And in the significant credit risk contract, if we accept view C, it's netted down in revenue on day one.
So Larry wants to.
Why? And that was a question that I forgot to ask, but it pertains to Tom's point. Why could C not be, you originally estimated at 60, all right, and that's your estimate originally, and then any changes from that go down to, or any deterioration from that goes down to impairment. I didn't understand why subsequent reductions in your estimate of the amount of revenue you would collect was reflected as revenue as opposed to down below as an impairment charge.
Because they're viewing it as variable consideration.
In part, C was just... As we sort of had envisaged, C would just remove that judgment. So once, if you get into this net of contracts, well, then that's what you do. I think you could get to the answer you just suggested, Larry, under alternative A, because it wouldn't preclude subsequent reassessments.
I don't think we precluded a presentation with C, but I think just for the avoidance of multiple versions of things, we tried to keep it isolated to where that part was.
Is it true if we vote for C that we would have to change the constraints application most likely to both point in time and overtime contracts?
I think, you know, that's something we were planning on mentioning sort of when we teed up the paper C, but I think if you do go to alternative C, it puts a little bit more pressure on the decision in that paper. And I think we as staff were thinking that actually that the point in time and overtime minimums requirement in that paper doesn't make as much sense with the alternative C as it does with the other alternatives, because it tries to make the cut on a performance-based rationale, whereas in C you're mixing up some things because of the incorporation of credit risk into the variable consideration.
Why don't you have that problem under view A if you judge it as a potential price consideration? Why don't you have the same issue?
I think there is a bit of a tension there, but I think it's perhaps less pronounced because we don't deem it in every case. So
But in the scenario I'm talking about is you've judged it and you've deemed it to be a price concession.
Then
you have the same issue in A and C.
Stephen, are you done, Tom? Oh, hold on. Sorry. Go ahead.
Is the tension between 52.1 and 53.1B diminished some under C? Because 52.1 says none of the credit risk is in transaction price. Obviously, in high credit risk situations, it would be. And so the tension that says it's not in transaction price ever, but then you got to decide if it's a concession, that would be reduced. Is that not true?
Yeah, I think regardless of whether we go option A, B, or C, we will rework the drafting in this area just to avoid that sort of apparent conflict. Essentially what we're saying with alternative A and alternative C, if there is significant credit risk in the transaction, that's suggestive that you've offered an implicit price concession. Therefore, it is variable consideration. Therefore, you need to estimate, well, what amount do you expect to be entitled to, which would be reflective of the amount you expect to receive. So strictly speaking, 52.1 is still correct. We're not adjusting the transaction price for the effects of customer credit risk. It is indicative, though, and this is a very fine distinction, it is indicative, though, that you've offered a price concession. And how do you measure the price concession? By reference to the customer credit risk. That's the confusion we'll try to resolve.
Tightrope to walk in.
Yeah, which is why we will change it. But the emphasis would be more on whatever we choose to do with alternative A, B, or C. I think that will drive how we present some of this drafting in this section on variable consideration.
At our Ed session, there was a conversation about the necessity to make clear that paragraph 14 is just about the existence of the contract and not necessarily the transaction amount, the transaction price, which is different from what Philippe described in his first statements.
Yeah.
Does the staff agree with that assessment, and have you contemplated the suggestion of adding a sentence at the end of 14 to clarify that fact? So instead of there's a contract, but to determine transaction price, go to 50.
Oh yes, we'll avoid that confusion that exists in the current staff draft to say existence of a contract doesn't take into account what you determine the transaction price should be. It's all about whether or not the parties are committed to the contract. When you want to consider what is the transaction price, that is dealt with in paragraph 50 thereabouts.
Thanks for answering all those questions, except you didn't answer the first one. Do you have a recommendation? After thinking about all this, are you leaving it to us?
You have several recommendations.
There is A, B, and C. I think this probably won't sound as a very strong recommendation in a sense, and the paper also sort of reflected. There are pros and cons of each of the alternatives, and I think we've tried to demonstrate that. I think something that Mark said, and I think something that's been said in the last couple of days, A and C aren't necessarily poles apart in terms of the outcomes you would get. The main difference is A has judgment that would be required between the two. C is just absolute. There is, as Philippe said before, still some judgment would be required under C because it only applies if you've got the significant credit components in the contract. But we would also think under A, if you have just normal credit risk contracts all the time, the fact that you've offered a price concession on one contract for the particular customer class wouldn't necessarily taint that customer class for all time if you were subsequently making an adjustment. So I don't see A and C being terribly different from each other. But
so the recommendation is?
Not B is what it sounds like.
Well,
the hidden recommendation is B.
Yeah, thank you. I didn't.
Sorry,
you're going to come to versus B.
I think we should stick to A. I also don't see a massive difference between A and C. Glenn, you said that A is judgment and C is absolute. I think A is a principle and C is a rule. That's how I would characterize it, because I think there is a principle in A, and I think your clarifications would get to that principle much more clearly. I think in many cases, if there is high credit risk, alternative A will give you the same answer as alternative C, but I think it is a more principles-based approach, and it's clear what the objective is. I think C, you might want from an anti-abuse perspective. You think that people are offering implicit price concessions, but they somehow would prefer to show it as credit risk. So, I mean, I wouldn't object to C, but I think the better standard-setting approach is to stick with A. Having said all of that, alternative B, I actually think, is the more logical approach because not alternative B as written. You know that I still feel that revenue should be measured at the fair value of the consideration, as in current IFRS literature, and that would require taking into account both time value of money and credit in assessing the revenue on day one. However, we expose B. Nobody liked the idea of having revenue at anything other than the invoice amount. Nobody liked the idea of having impairments adjacent to revenue or built into revenue. We've exposed it. We've talked about it. We've moved away from it. So I think we should just close off B and drive on. So that's why I wouldn't do B. The concern I have, though, something Tom raised, is about what happens if there is a significant financing component. So I know you've assumed there isn't one here, and it all works fine. My concern is, does it work when there is a significant financing component? So take alternative A, example 3, where we're saying that this high credit risk is indicative of a price concession, so we measure revenue at 60. Now, if there is a significant financing component, so let's suppose this invoice amount is due in 1 year and 1 day from now, so it trips over the 1 year and we are discounting, what discount rate do we apply to that 60? How does it interact with our impairment proposals? Now, you all know that I think that our impairment proposals double count. I think this has the risk of triple counting, because you are taking into account the credit risk in measuring the 60, then you discount the 60 at a credit risk adjusted discount rate, so that's double counting, and then the ISB would put on a 12-month allowance and the FASB a lifetime allowance, so then you're triple counting on the credit risk. So I have a lot of concern about the whole model for measuring revenue and taking into account credit in the context of a significant financing program.
We'll cause a terrible
recession. We'll have to clarify that, because presumably the logic would be that you'd have to assess impairment of the collectability of the 60, because it wouldn't make sense to measure impairment on the collectability of 100 if you haven't recognised it.
Yeah.
But we'll need to make that clear.
But you would be discounting the 60.
Yeah, we'll have to think about discounting.
So one option for the boards would be to say that alternative A or C applies to contracts without a significant financing component. The staff draft, as it stands, and it was the same in the 2011 ED, says if you have a contract with a significant financing component, customer credit risk is dealt with, as Tom said, in the selection of the discount rate used to discount the promise consideration. So what you would get under the staff draft currently in that example 3 is you would say it's fixed price contract. You would say promise consideration is 100. You would discount that at the credit adjusted discount rate. And I think using the sort of the facts here, you would get a present value number of 60. That would be your revenue. You would then apply the impairment proposals to your receivable, which is currently measured at 60, and you would sort of recognize that.
So where does the price concession bit come in? That's fine, but that's assuming there's no price concession.
Yeah.
So surely you have to build that in as well?
So Well, this is, sorry, what's the facts?
In order to get down to 60, you've deemed it a price concession. Right. So what he's saying is that if you've deemed it a price concession and you do your appropriate discount rate, do you do it off the 100, which is the contractual amount, or do you deem it off of your new transaction price, which is 60?
So to the extent, but to the extent you would discount, then if you've taken the credit risk in your expected value type calculation of what is the amount you expect to be entitled to, i.e. 60, you would probably have to discount that using a risk-free rate.
Yes, exactly. I mean, that's the right answer. So my concern is we get drafting that gets us to the right answer.
Yeah,
that still leaves the other bit of the triple counting, the double counting bit, but that's a different
one. Make it better. Make it
that's not our point.
The credit risk is zero.
Gary?
I'll not say
and then I'll go to Gary.
The credit risk is zero. You should be careful. Yeah, it could be, but you just should not say risk-free. The only addition to Stephen is I will not say it's risk-free. I will say credit risk approach is zero. I think we need to think about it. We should not say it should be risk-free discount rate. We should say credit risk approximates to zero in that situation where you know you factored in it. Because I don't want to say it's risk-free for this, credit risk for the other, but you need to take an appropriate discount rate. That appropriate discount rate takes into account credit risk in some situations to be low. And in this situation, it will be low.
Gary?
Okay. In the facts in this example, I think A is the right answer for a number of reasons. And part of it deals with why I don't think B and C are. I don't believe B provides much of an answer in the world because you're still showing the top line revenue of 100, and I just don't believe that's where the focus in earnings releases and analysts' comments. It's not going to be in the 60; it's going to be in the 100. It's a number that's consistent with how you used to compute in the past. So it's sort of interesting to have a contra account there. But I just got to believe practice is still going to focus on the 100. Secondly, I think income statements, I mean, this is a line. There should be a very high-level snapshot, fewer lines, not filling it up with details. You could probably make equivalent arguments against a lot of lines that you should break out a component of on the face of the P&L before you got to get a so 6, 8, 9 lines. You've got a lot of lines. I think C, in this particular example, I think it actually is less transparent because I think credit risk in the I do business with people who I expect to pay but cannot pay is a highly visible, highly focused on number, and you lose that.
No, you don't. C starts off with when you enter in the transaction, you didn't expect them to pay.
That
judgment is never disclosed.
The judgment's never disclosed. I mean, I think the world learns more about your business by seeing 100 with the credit impairment line, either in the cost and expenses or in a foot. I just think it communicates more than 60. You never knew the 40 existed in alternative C.
Even if you don't expect the person to ever pay 100.
But I'm going to say you can never agree.
Right.
That C doesn't apply in some cases, and I'll give an example in a minute. I think here's the case. First of all, I'm sort of with Larry, is I'm not even sure this is a commercial reality, in here that you sell something for 100, you incur costs commensurate with that levels of effort, I'm only going to get 40%. I'm not sure the example would so commonly exist as to, you need to bake this into standards. I think cases where C could make some sense, and first of all, we got it, I think, in example 3, but I'll use a different one. If you're a defense contractor and you bill cost plus, say 15% markup, you really believe you're entitled to that, but you also know the defense contract audit agency is going to absolutely come in and you're going to negotiate a final settle price. So you believe you're entitled to, but you never expect to get it. That, in examples like that, C sort of makes some sense, to me. That's sort of like a list price to negotiate from.
Right.
Even though you believe you're entitled to it, you know it's going to be discreetly challenged, and you settle on something different. So I think, again, back to A, I think you're entitled to 100, but you act accordingly that you're entitled to 100. the, and I think if you have that big of a credit charge, I think this is a better communication vehicle than say.
Daryl Buck?
I think there are a lot of things to like about alternative C, but I am troubled by what I think is sort of a counterintuitive thing, which is that you're entering into a contract with significant credit risk, and then subsequent downward adjustments in your estimate of what you're going to collect never appears in bad debt expense. That I think is a bit troublesome, but I wouldn't fix it by going to alternative B. I didn't support alternative B the first time around, and I consider that water under the bridge, so I would not resurrect alternative B.
Some say bridge under the water, but that's okay.
Only in the Netherlands do you have it.
So, you know, I would propose that either we modify alternative C, as Larry was alluding to have those subsequent adjustments go through bad debt expense, or if we think then that violates what we're trying to treat this at, which is variable consideration, then I would have to default to alternative A.
Daryl Scott?
I originally was going to speak before Stephen spoke. Stephen said a lot of what I was going to say, but I just want to now perhaps reemphasize after Gary's spoken. I think, Gary, the example you gave of when you thought C might apply, to my mind, that's when A kicks in and pushes you into that treatment in any case. So I think in that circumstance, A is doing its job. The point that Stephen made about the principle and that A is a principle approach is perhaps the reason why I would be a supporter of A. And it's because, to my mind, there are circumstances where you make sales at significant, with significant credit risk, where it really is about credit risk. Your intent is to enforce it. You will chase that money down, but there is still significant risk. And I think that should be reported differently, because in those circumstances, I think the bad debt number, the impairment number, on the face of the income statement makes absolute sense. They may be the minimum or the very few transactions that fall into that place. And we may want to push through the wording that we use to say that you should really think hard if it's a price concession. But I think the wording in 53-odd gets us there to a large extent anyway, by encouraging you to think about it that way. But to my mind, there are distinct differences between the two types of transactions, and overriding the principle doesn't make sense.
I'm not saying that we should not re-debate. However, if we think about the population of the transactions, I do have a sympathy about medical care industry in the U.S. and timeshare. However, I think the population is quite low. And if we go down the path to the B, then we would inspire lots of shortcomings of B, and we should re-scrutinize the shortcomings of alternative B. I think we should avoid such things. And in normal business circumstances, nobody really make a transaction with the customer with a significant credit problem. And having said that, we should think about alternative C, but I don't think alternative C really works. Because the shortcoming of alternative C is it is deemed, and we need to make a clear clarification of what is the threshold. And eventually it will incorporate kind of idea of threshold. And we are saying that entitlement and the credit risk is the separate things. So coming back to that notion, principle, we should stick to alternative A.
Al?
You may notice a trend between the users here and everyone else. If you were to sit down with an investor and give them this sheet of paper, I would be surprised if a supermajority did not pick B. Because when you compare B to C, B just gives you more information. And particularly what you'd be focusing on is the company stretching for customers? Are they stretching from an impairment standpoint? Are they stretching from or a credit quality standpoint? Are they stretching from I'll give you any concession. And if we move and decouple or de-link impairment and concession from the revenue numbers, particularly with A, you're making the analysis more difficult. The analyst is going to have to take more time, think more about these numbers. So what I liked about B is you give me the pieces. Over time, I can see if when they're stretching and when they're not, and we go through cycles here. And it's probably the most concise and consistent, and I think I also accept the argument that was made in the paper that A is not going to be clearly and consistently applied between companies. At least B eliminates that. So I think from an investor standpoint, hands down, B is the best answer.
So how do you respond to Ian's concern, or many concerns of the timing?
I think that's a fair comment. And the way most analyst models are set up, it's timelines or series of quarterly data. And what you would see is the top line revenue number. And I disagree with this comment, but they would only focus on that. They would then see the adjustments, regardless of whether it's impairment or concession, and then a net revenue number. And they would watch that time series over time. And they would be linking those changes to economic cycles. Did they see an acceleration of growth? And then two quarters later, oh, wait, I've got an impairment issue or a concession issue. And they would notice that over time. Management then, the company, would gain a reputation for certain things in certain economic environments, and that would get filtered into the analysis process.
Yeah, this is why my first choice would be.
Excellent choice.
No, I like it, but it's too late.
So even if it's better, it doesn't work.
No, that's not the point. The point is that we tried that in 2011 ED. We tried in 2011 ED, and it was overwhelmingly rejected. That's the reason. That's the reason for it's too late. It's not because we can't bring it up. It's because 2011 ED was exactly on that, and you have seen the comment letters, 750 of them, of which 600 of them are against it. So,
and the 650 were
incorrect. No, sorry.
I'm just throwing a number.
Well,
but 750 was accurate.
Well, the second ED, we had about 350 comment letters back, right? So, I think it's fair that people, the concerns that have been raised in the paper and the prior papers are still present in it. I think those that support it, and there are those that support it, that I think it does provide some of this relief that Hal's describing. It has flaws that everyone's identified, but I think there is no perfect solution here. So it's where is your preference lie in some of the imperfection of any of them?
And aren't we here really to try and deal with this fatal flaw comment, which is about the judgments, not really reopening what's the best information, et cetera?
Do you want to argue for A or C or just...
No, I want to ask you. I already made my pitch yesterday, and I don't want to repeat myself for supporting A. My only concern or comment to the FASB is that if we go for A, is FASB going to come back and do something for the timeshares or something like that to deal with those situations in any other way? Because the concern emanates that you want to put a sledgehammer and force people to do it in one way, and especially in high-risk industries. So is there any thought, if you go to A, that you would do something with C? It's similar to C. That's what I wanted to ask.
But let's see how the debate continues. I don't know. Mark?
Well, we don't have a project. I don't think there's any intention at this point to... I mean, this is the debate that we're having. We're not talking about one particular industry later on. I mean, we'll see if there's implementation, things that come up. But I had a few things that I wanted to comment on. I think the history is really important here, and the change that we're making to get rid of the collectability threshold that both IFRS and US GAAP have had in place for decades. We're getting rid of the collectability threshold. And now we're setting up a model that will allow everything to go into revenue, irrespective of credit risk. And so all the arguments that say, well, today price concessions are done just for, to maintain a customer relationship or something like that, don't really matter, because we're setting up a new model that's going to have a completely different arbitrage between price concessions and impairment expense. Right? So if it's a price concession, it goes into variable consideration and will be constrained. If you don't deem it to be a price concession, you get full revenue. You get full gross margin. You don't get the, then you get it all down below, any impairment expense down below. And so having eliminated a collectability threshold and allowing everything to go into revenue, I worry about everything that Hal mentioned, except that it's more exacerbated now because we've gotten rid of the collectability threshold. At the sign of anybody, any company having problems with, you know, growing their top line, all they have to do is start dipping into customers that have more and more credit quality problems, and the revenue growth goes up. And so I've just got a big, big problem with that, and I do think that we do have to address, like, what's decision useful for investors at this point. And if it reopens a debate, it reopens a debate. But that's why I'm generally in favor of B. I've always been in favor of B. At this point, I understand all the feedback that we got, and I understand Ian's concern about some of it's going to relate to prior years' revenue. I think one way to address it is to just do B for high credit risk situations at inception. In those cases, then you would do B. I'd be fine with that. I would not object to C as a way to move forward, too. But I do think that A, given where we've been with the collectability threshold, will encourage more people to just say, well, I don't have any signs of price concessions, and it'll all be under the full recognition model and show up down below as an impairment expense later.
Mauro?
Yeah, thanks. As someone mentioned, I guess, was that there's no perfect model here. So, but although alternative C, the only real merit I see is that it's treating implicit and explicit price concession at the same way. However, I do prefer the imperfection of A because it's more principles-based. Under C, we'll need at least, and considering Mark's suggestion to overcome the difficulties in the impairment, mixing off many years' numbers to treat high credit risk at inception, we'll need any way to define what we do believe is significant credit risk. And I do think this will take an enormous amount of time and we will not reach a clear concept of significant credit risk. So I would stick with A, with a principles-based, and then with the inherent judgment that this would be necessary to be applied.
I know more want to get in on a second round, so go ahead, Tom.
I actually try to stay true to the vault that we had previously when I made this evaluation, even though it was counter to how I had voted, because I had voted for B previously. And what caused me to come back to B was this extreme tension that's in the model in paragraphs 52.1 and 53.1b about distinguishing concessions from credit risk. And while I admire the staff for trying to come up with a principle in A, I just don't see it working, especially when I look at paragraph 34 relative to paragraph 31. It gets extremely complicated in those judgments. I think paragraph 31 has a principle, but I think the staff believes they need paragraph 34 to operationalize it. And I'm not sure how that really works because does any one of those I think the staff means any one of those factors exist and it is going to be variable. It at least has to be improved in that way to make clear if one does exist and two don't exist, how do you make the judgment in 34? So I think you're saying if any of one of those exists, but at times when I've thought through the application of paragraph 34 and those factors, some of them feel that they run counter to the paragraph 31 principles. And so I think we have to seriously evaluate whether you can actually work the ideas that the staff has rightly tried to put in place, and I've convinced myself, no. Well, I like principle base, it's not going to work. So I've come back to B because if I can't distinguish easily between a concession and an impairment, even for all the reasons that our our constituents rightly raise the issues. If I can't distinguish between those two, I think you have to put it adjacent. And I don't know that we're going to get a model that you can distinguish between those effectively.
Kerry?
What I was originally going to say, and I want to modify for what Mark and I think Tom both said, I think company, when you talk about stretching for a new business and taking on higher credit risk, I mean, there's other ways that will come through in the financial statements concurrently. Is you'll see it in gross margin, it perhaps in which segment of the business it's hitting. Very shortly in your credit disclosures, you can start seeing aging. There's more than one way than just this line item that stretching for revenue will come through the financial statements. So when you start seeing receivables growing faster than revenue, it means they're aging, and so on and so on. You'll see write-off rates, presumably, will start to rise. A bit of a lag, perhaps. I think with respect to when I said the focus will still be on revenue, it's still probably primarily preparers, focusing on revenue. Analysts can focus on what revenue number they want to focus on. Bad debts would commonly be a disclosed number. It's entirely capable, to do on a net revenue, in your model as opposed to the face of the statements, just as you do pre and post currency, core and non-core businesses, and so on for modeling. I think just not so sure B gets you that much. I still think you're going to have, the debate over what's a concession or a variable that's in the top line versus a concession versus an impairment, an uncollectability impairment in the second line. I'm not sure you get all that much out of it. And I go back to a statement I said yesterday. I think companies generally should be assumed, why they collect or why they don't collect the amounts they believe is due them. So I'm sure there's going to be some cases in the middle where if it's a bad debt versus a concession, it's going to be gray and reasonable people can differ. But I think in the main, why you're collecting things and why you're not collecting things.
Stephen?
Just wanted to pick up on something that PK said. He mentioned timeshare sales. To my mind, there are two situations where selling subject to high credit risk makes sense for a company. One is when there's very low marginal cost to what you're producing. Push it out, doesn't really matter whether people pay you, you still make some money. So software is the best example. The other one is where there's a high collateral value to what you're selling and you can recover it. And real estate, timeshare sales, anything with a value that holds, that you can recover the asset. And those two are quite different situations. And I just wanted to check that the timeshare sales works with A, because to my mind, you can argue that the software sale where you don't expect to collect it is a price concession, but could you argue that for a timeshare sale? Because you're not really giving a price concession, you're taking the property back in lieu of payment. So you're still going to recover the value, but you're going to recover it through the collateral effectively rather than giving a price concession. It doesn't seem to me the timeshare sales fits into the price concession type thinking.
The FASB is going to have to make consequential amendments for timeshares because today there's specific on-point industry guidance that effectively says don't make this determination between a return, product return, or collectability intertwined. But it goes further than that. It impacts the inventory balance reported, the number of sales. They don't want duplicative sales of units if they only expect to sell it once. So there's a variety of things we will need to consequentially amend, but obviously that's all impacted by what decision you take here that's the starting point.
I mean, but timeshare sales is just one example.
Also an evaluation of paragraph 14.
That's right.
Whether you even get in.
If we clarify 14.
You mentioned about right of return, and that's what I effectively think is going on with the timeshare and other similar high collateral value type situations. Is that a possible way of dealing with this as well? So we're arguing here about credit versus concession. What about credit versus right of return? I've always felt that the timeshare sales is about right to return.
Actually, it's a variable consideration.
Yeah, I think what we're talking about is credit or variable consideration.
Yeah.
So price concession and right return is the same philosophy.
Same variable consideration. Yeah.
We can relabel this, yeah. I think. Yeah.
Well, okay. I'm not convinced it works. But if you say you thought about it, then fine.
Done. Larry?
So I'm quoting from paper C, I think. The core principle of the revenue standard is to depict the transfer of goods or services to the customer in an amount that reflects the consideration to which the entity expects to be entitled for transferring. I am in Daryl's camp and a bunch of other people's camp that I don't believe alternative B reflects that whatsoever because of the fact that you're mixing up in revenue amounts related to prior periods, et cetera. So I voted against alternative B to begin with, and I continue to be against alternative B. I think there have been a lot of good points raised in terms of the advantages of alternative A over C. C is clearly advantageous from the standpoint that people don't have to think about it. You just go in and you have an answer. But I don't think that's a good reason for selecting it. I guess my major concern with A, quite frankly, which was also my concern with C, is that because you're using variable consideration as your, the key behind the decision, you stick to it all the way. So even in example three, the reduction in the subsequent reduction in your expected credit price or amount that you're going to collect also is a reduction under alternative A to subsequent revenue. And I guess I would ask whether we can tailor it to say, okay, evaluate it on day one from a variable consideration standpoint, but then lock it in terms of your expectations so that subsequent changes flow through the impairment line. Because I truly, like Daryl said, I truly believe that your subsequent reductions are going to reflect impairment. Now, I haven't thought through the potential flaws of that.
That's a very consistent approach, Larry.
Yeah.
Because effectively you're doing almost the same thing for significant financing when there's significant financing in the sense there's significant credit only and not time value, and you'd be doing exactly what we do for significant financing.
It would deal with the inconsistency that I brought up before. Only subsequent stuff goes through impairment. The starting point is...
Right. So that's the way I would deal with it. Also, in terms of your specific recommendations, in terms of setting the principles, in paragraph 31, you have a... sub B, it says the entity explicitly promises price concessions, discounts. I would get rid of that. I mean, if that's supposed to be a day one consideration, like I said earlier, that doesn't exist in contracts.
Where are you again, Larry?
I'm in paragraph 31 of A, paragraph, I could say. So it says... examples of facts and circumstances you should consider. The entity does not intend to enforce the stated contract price. Okay, I agree with that. And then B, it says the entity explicitly promises price concessions discounts. You don't do that in your contract. You don't enter into a revenue contract and say, I'm going to charge you $100,000, but don't worry about it because I'm going to reduce it by $40,000.
You might through a reseller. It's not uncommon that I sell to you, right, and then you resell it to an actual retailer, and if they have to discount the price, I share that discount with you.
It's not because of credit,
but...
That's the indirect channels model, yeah. You know, where price protection and those things come in.
You're right, it's not because of credit.
So I wouldn't have that okay. Person.
Larry,
can I understand fully your ideas?
Hold on. Kristen wants to follow up.
Yeah, sorry, just one thing, and I appreciate what Henry and you're suggesting. I just wanted to remind everyone, though, because the 2010 ED did try to make that distinction between day one and then subsequently. So it would require then, if you make a change and you ultimately collect all of it, say, or you had a change in the estimate you had.
It only goes in one direction. I realize that.
It's like a bunch of rules.
I just want to make sure that's clear. Yeah.
You You okay?
Yeah. No. Let me say, you know, assume the original expectation is you can get 60. So you will book 60 as revenue. Then later on, because of performance of the quality of the products, the seller promise, if the quality is not good, I will give you further deduction. You give me 50 or 30. You will say another 30 as impairment?
No, that's a different situation. I was talking about credit. Just price concessions related to credit, period.
Right. So let's do Pat and we'll see if we can vote.
The length and breadth of discussion has helped me greatly. C, I thought, has too many knock-on consequences, so I can't accept it. And for the reasons that other people have supported A, I would be willing to support A. But the discussion is demonstrating that there's a need around these choices for better disclosure about exactly what is occurring, you know, when you book the revenue, and whether or not you have a price concession or whether or not you have an assessment of you know, impairment. And so for all the reasons that Mark Siegel identified, I think it's incumbent upon us to do something. If we're taking this much time and we have this much angst about which choice here, it begs the question that, you know, if you don't have sufficient disclosure around these judgments, you're not really improving or communicating very well what your revenue is. And so I think it's incumbent upon us not to just say, well, I'll take A, I'll take B, I'll take C, but to embellish it here with some additional disclosure. When I read paragraph 44, and I had Ian's concern too, but the note I wrote on the side of the page was, use two lines. Use two lines. Here's the current period, and here's all prior period adjustments. I mean, how hard is that? You could put that.
Cost for check.
Well, it's by deduction. You know what the current period is. Everything else is prior period.
Pat, it's more than just time. Some of that impairment will be genuine impairment. Some will be price concession, and that's really how you'd have to break it out. And you know.
But if you're making that judgment, then you should disclose it.
But okay. I thought the existing disclosure requirements that we were going to put in the document talked about needing to disclose judgments, assumptions.
But it's so bland, Russ, that's the kind of thing that elicits boilerplate disclosure, okay. Unless you make it specific.
Do we have anything in the EITF on healthcare?
I don't know.
There was disclosure, I think.
Perhaps we could use that as an example or something. So let me test the water here on where the preferences are. I've heard some people want view A, some people want view B, some people want view C. So how many from a first preference want view B? I don't think I'm going to get a majority, so then I'm going to take it off the table. But how many from a first preference?
Everybody.
ISB first. View B. Okay. FASB? Three. Okay. So now, if we're just voting on view from an ISB perspective, view A. Okay, that's majority.
16.
Okay. From an FASB standpoint, view A. Okay. So I'm view C. You didn't figure that out.
At the Ed session, we knew you were Busey.
That was all first preference.
So now, if from a convergence standpoint, if view B is not acceptable, who on the FASB could accept view A? So I can accept view A, but my first preference is view C. Okay.
With Larry's suggestion?
Five is strong.
Yep.
With Larry's hesitation of subsequent changes being an impairment.
Yeah. Is that okay with the ISB?
Not sure about
that. I don't know how you do that, to be honest with you.
I thought that suggestion was on alternative C.
Well, once you get so Larry's position is on day one, you've concluded it's likely you'll give a price concession because of credit. That puts you in a variable consideration, but the amount that you have reasonable or sufficient confidence on day one is the amount you are now you believe you're entitled to. Any subsequent change down results in an impairment expense.
Well, but then it's not variable consideration.
It's only variable consideration on the first day, not on the second
That's
day.
That's complicating the model.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, take it off the table.
I wasn't talking about that. I was talking about simply disclosure.
Okay,
thanks,
Larry. So, to help with that. So, you want a flowchart, Larry? Where we are right now is both the FASB and the ISB are supportive of view A.
Yeah.
All right, so now we got to go back to the first three questions, right?
Yes.
The paper?
Yep.
So those first three questions sort of arrive after paragraph 22 of the paper. And these are more, I guess you would sort of characterize as drafting improvements. The first would be because of the confusion that we've heard from reviewers about paragraph 14, we would clarify that obviously when you're assessing, in particular paragraph 14E, which is about assessing the sort of the intent of the parties and their commitment to the contract, you would just have to consider, make an overall qualitative assessment of the facts and circumstances, and we would eliminate the indicators 1 to 3 that were presented in 14E on the basis that they led to more confusion rather than clarification.
Just question one. You want to
I guess that was question one. Question two and question three are all about sort of deleting those words from paragraph 50 and paragraph 53.1B. But, of course, that's not going to be removed from the model entirely. We will be capturing the idea from alternative A in the draft standard.
Wego?
You know, we conclude A, and it will have some implications on the questions we now are discussing. I will prefer, as I said before, delete E at all. E still creates confusion between whether the step when we assess whether there is a genuine contract or assess anything related to collectability. My fear is, you know, we confuse ourselves. As I said from beginning, I always said, you know, revenue is from exchange transaction. We have to take into consideration of payment. But we decide not, you know, because it's based on transfer notion, and we rule out, and we decide to define revenue as the amount you expect to entitled. Then E won't have an assessment about if someone may not intend to pay, or the seller may not enforce to get the money. I think we confuse ourselves. If there is a false transactions and both sides sign a contract, it's so obviously it is not genuine contract. My personal view is either put in 14A, we can slightly different, you know, combined the, now let's look at the appendix. Yes. Now the A is the contract has a commercial substance. I will change it like this, you know. It is genuine contract with commercial substance. And then have a little bit explanations what genuine contract means. And kick out those ungenuine contracts. Not discuss about amount itself. You know, amount related to the credit risk, I will only, you know, lead to, you know, impairment assessment due to financial instrument standards, not related to revenue standards.
But the staff is on paragraph 14E, they're proposing to retain the sentences the parties are committed to perform the respective obligations they intend to enforce their respective contractual rights. You're proposing to retain that and only that,
yeah.
Right?
But the key idea is here. We still, the key idea behind this paragraph is to assess the amount
No,
I think.
No, it's to try to make sure the contract's substantive.
Yeah. That's right.
The amounts.
So the amounts will be assessed in paragraph 50 on determining the transaction price.
Now, if that is the case, I fully agree with you. Know, now this paragraph nothing to do with anything. With the amount related to any possible credit risk.
And this,
if that is the case,
I understand 14 is a gate. Once you get in, then you use the other aspects of the model to determine the transaction price, to determine when there's been a transfer of control.
But yeah. Now let's use example to test. Yeah. My understanding, your explanation is right. U.S. healthcare. You know, the contract amount is 100. And traditionally, the provider enforces half.
Yeah.
What amount?
Half.
100, half?
Well, that doesn't matter.
Under 14, it is a contract. Under 14, it is a contract. Then you come to para 50. Then you have to do the para 55 to see whether what is the expected value or most likely amount. Then you need to do the remaining paragraphs. So, under para 14, you got the treatment. It is a genuine contract. Para 14 right now is intended to see whether it's a bona fide transaction or not. That's all it's trying to do.
Yeah. Now, use this example. I put into the addendum C and the example 4 and the U.S. healthcare. And start with 100 or 50?
50. The healthcare is example 3, not 4 in the paper. Because you can't, in healthcare, you can never tell if it's a price concession because you don't actually bill your rack rate, but you don't actually get it, or is it a credit concession?
Even under A, you will get $50,000.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, even under option A, the which we voted for, in your example of $100,000, and they ultimately collect only $50, that will under like. Russ said, it's example 3, you get to 50,000 as a revenue. You don't book 100,000 and book 50,000 of bad debt.
So, no, I personally not agree with. It's because, you know, as I said, you know, legally, you know, we define revenue, the amount you're entitled.
And what the thought is what you're entitled to is what's going to eventually be negotiated with a customer, which is not the 100, it's the 50 in your example.
But and the example, no. The examples in the previous draft, you know, not mentioned in the future negotiation. You know, if there is future negotiation, I can see why 50.
Let me.
But
give
the example, no. Let me finish. Okay. The examples in the previous several draft never tell us, you know, there is a future negotiation after first bill. Now, if after first bill, the both sides understand there will be second negotiation, for example, from the company level or others.
Right.
I can accept. But the example clearly said you build the other side 1,000 or 100, and but you history show you only enforce half. I will not accept to book half. You know, if there is a second negotiation, as I said, through union or through the companies, I can accept because the first price is just like the offer price, not the real price. You know, the example gave us the impression the price is contractual and legally, you know, enforceable.
Okay, why don't we, so we move on, why don't we take and work on improving the example? But Mark?
Are you, so you're thinking, you answered Russ's question that you're going to keep that first sentence in 14E. Right, and then supplement it with in applying with what you have in the question, which says in applying the criteria in 14E, an entity should make an overall qualitative assessment of the facts and circumstances of the contract. Is that how you intend to?
Yeah. Well, what do you take off exactly from 14E? Where do you start the elimination? Is it the first sentence after the first sentence, or do you keep shall consider all facts and circumstances? Do you keep it or not? That's important.
The reason that I raise it is just if you keep that first sentence of 14E as it stands, the parties are committed to perform and enforce their respective contractual rights. I just worry that that's a pretty harsh assessment. I thought what
as
you were
in,
thinking
like,
about
all.
Doing all. I had assumed what you were going to do is replace that first sentence in 14E with something like what you have in the question. to soften it. So
I mean, we.
I just want, it's a drafting issue. I just want to raise it.
So we need to make it clear that you're going to enforce some of the rights, but not necessarily all of the rights.
Yes. It's just the way it's written now. Yeah. Yeah. I can see people saying it's all, and this partial performance thing is going to cause is going to cause confusion.
In essence, really, what 14E and really 14 was all of, and 14 in total is all about is assessing commitments of the parties to the contract. Do they believe in the contract? Do they intend to honor the contract?
As a whole, but when you start to say contractual, you know, enforce those rights. Yeah. Now I start to.
Yeah, it's the same point. We talk about this at the Ed session. I'm going to ask you whether you're going to accept a change of this variety. You can write it better, I'm sure. The conclusion from this paragraph, that's 14, shall determine whether there is a contract between the entity and its customer. The conclusion from this paragraph does not determine the amount expected to be entitled under the contract. Paragraphs 50, 52.1, 53.1 provides guidance in determining the amount expected to be entitled under the contract.
That's good.
And that will deal with Wegwo's issue. It'll say there is a meeting of mind, there is a contract, but you're not enforcing necessarily all of the transaction price. Look to other guidance to determine the amount.
So your idea is to include this observation?
Yes.
Yeah. At the bottom of 14.
Yeah. So, just an additional clarification to be even more clear that this is only the entrance door to the whole model.
That's right. And that variable consider the amount will be determined looking elsewhere, not here.
Yeah. How once again?
I agree with Tom's addition. I just want to make sure I understood. When I read this after you redraft it, is it going to say that they intend to enforce the substance of the contract or all the contract terms? Because those are dramatically different things. As written here, as Marcus pointed out, this is very narrowly written.
Well, that's why I liked what you wrote.
Effective contractual.
That's what I liked what you wrote in 14 in the question. An entity should make an overall qualitative assessment of the facts and circumstances of the contract with the customer to determine if the parties are to the contract are committed to the contract. We're not talking about. We don't mention rights. We don't mention enforcement. Yes. So you committed to the contract.
I was not clear.
It's not so narrow of an assessment that some term that perhaps is in a model form doesn't, by the entity, get enforced on a regular basis such that that contract would be deemed not to be a contract.
Okay.
You're pulling
this language in and substituting it for the old existing language here.
Yes. I think what we're saying is we appreciate all the concerns that have been raised about this paragraph. We will do our best to make sure it's clear that it's a substantive assessment that one does at the start of a negotiation or a thinking that you might have an agreement between two parties.
I look forward to reading what you come up with.
Daryl, Buck. I agree with the staff's suggestions on the deletion of words there in 14 and 50. And I think that those serve to clarify that, you know, 14 is identifying whether or not you're even in and have a contract, and then 50 is where the measurement of the price occurs. I agree with Tom's suggestion to sort of make the link, if you will, there. One of the other things that we talked about in our education session was the fact that if you take in paragraph 50, the second half of 50, you know, beginning with the word however, the staff is suggesting that we delete that, and I agree with that. But I think the combination of taking that out as well as everything under 14E, we lose a little bit of content there in terms of thinking about measurement. So one thing we talked about was the possibility of taking some words like 14E, 2, and 3, and moving those into 50 to give a little bit more flavor in terms of the measurement side of things. If they've previously chosen, not to enforce the full amount, or if they have experience with charging a different amount, say, than in the contract price. And I think that I would be in favor of something like that to give a little bit more guidance there in terms of how you come up with that price.
agree with Daryl on all of that. I want to ask one more question. When we talked about view A, the sentence that you're recommending being deleted in 53.1b was the one that people thought was the most important sentence about having credit risk potentially be treated as a price concession at inception. You're recommending that go away. Where is that concept in all of your recommendations? Because I'm not seeing it. It might just be I'm failing in searching it out. But that whole conversation was that sentence is important.
It is sort of the genesis of Alternative A. Part of the problem is with that sentence and the feedback we got was in isolation. It came in cold. No one knew really what to do with it or how to make the assessment. So Alternative A is mainly about just building that out further with additional things to think about when you make that assessment. Is it a price concession versus is it impairment?
Can you point to language in 31 to 38 that sort of builds that back in? I'm not seeing it.
Well, it needs to be.
Oh, you have to develop it. Okay. All right.
But I think it is.
Arguably in 33.
I didn't understand that answer, that it's to come. All right.
Yeah, but it's building in the premises that are in kind of the four captions that we had there about sort of distinction between and having some of that 28 to 30, 30, paragraph 31, assessment of facts and circumstance, paragraph 34, all of that kind of will become the improved 53.1.
I mean, so
with respect to questions 2 and 3, I don't hear anybody against eliminating confusion. With respect to question 1, there's been some additional clarity about 1A and the need to clarify the objective to talk more about a qualitative assessment, and the drafting's yet to come. So who would agree with that change, FASB first? Okay. ISB? Okay, great. So we're done with this memo. We were originally scheduled to go for a break, but the team tells me we're a little behind. So should we just try to keep going, and if you need to take a break, take a break? Okay.
So we're going to move to paper C, which is on the constraints of minimum.
We're going to judge the wording in the balloting process?
The pre-ballot.
The pre-ballot. That's the prep of the process. Yeah.
August 15th. Okay.
January 15th.
No.
Okay, moving on to paper C. So the constraint minimums requirements. So paper 7C considers the application of the constraint, specifically what happens when an entity determines that it can't include the full amount of its estimated variable consideration in the transaction price. So what does the entity do in those cases when, how do they determine whether a minimum amount or what that minimum amount should be included in the transaction price? So we refer to that typically as the minimum requirements. So the most recent staff draft included requirements for how to determine this minimum amount, and they're included in Appendix A. Specifically, the paragraph you want to refer to is 56.3. We included all of the paragraphs related to the constraint, but the minimum requirements are in 56.3. So those requirements were drafted based on the board's tentative decision in December 2012, which you may recall included deleting a paragraph from the 2011 ED, which was paragraph 85 of the 2011 ED, and that paragraph had specific requirements for recognizing revenue when there's a license of intellectual property and sales-based royalties. Paragraph 85 said that you recognize revenue for those sales-based royalties as those sales occur. So, but also in December, you discussed as part of deleting that paragraph that generally wanted to try and get the same outcome in those situations, but try to draft the constraint more broadly so that we got the same outcome. So part of that discussion also included an acknowledgement that a minimum amount in some situations could be zero, and that would help achieve that outcome of paragraph 85. It also happened in paragraph 85. So like sort of Kristen and Glenn said with sort of the overall tee up in their paper, the reason why we're here today is based on sort of some of the feedback that we heard as part of this, the drafting process and the review process. And some of the feedback related to these minimums requirements was that the drafting appeared complex and was difficult to understand in some cases. And I think other feedback that we heard, particularly from those in the pharmaceutical and the media and entertainment industry, they were concerned that that the outcome that may result from applying the minimum requirements as drafted may not always achieve what they knew to be the outcome under paragraph 85 in the 2011 review. So this paper includes two options for you today. The first option is primarily what was proposed in the staff drafts, and as I said, in Appendix A, paragraph 56.3. Now, these requirements draw a distinction for when an entity would include a minimum amount in the transaction price based on whether a performance obligation is satisfied at a point in time or over time. Specifically, the staff draft required that when the performance obligation is satisfied at a point in time, that minimum amount would be zero. Now, the rationale for that is in, I think, paragraphs 9 and 10 of that paper. And also there's an example, I think, after paragraph 15 that outlines that the reason why that the drafts made that distinction is to try and achieve the same outcomes as would have been achieved in paragraph 85 of the 2011 ED. And also because without those outcomes or without determining that that minimum amount could be zero when the performance obligation is satisfied at a point in time, you would get true-ups in the transaction price that wouldn't necessarily tie to the entity's performance. It wouldn't necessarily tie to the cash that's received. Now, another thing I'll mention is that as part of option one, to address some of the concerns about complexity or difficulty in understanding the drafting, the staff has pulled together Appendix C, which is a flow chart, to try and help people walk through the requirements of the constraint. And perhaps we could consider including some of that in the drafting. Now, the second option for the boards to consider today is quite a bit closer to the 2011 ED. So this approach would not require the point in time or overtime distinction, as would in option one, but rather it would include a requirement similar to paragraph 85 of the 2011 ED. So that is, again, where there's a license of an intellectual property and there's variable consideration. That variable consideration would not be included in the transaction price until that uncertainty is resolved. For example, a sales-based royalty until those sales occur. Now, just based on some questions at the Ed session, there is a slight difference between what we have proposed in the drafting in Appendix D, which is the proposed drafting for Option 2, and Paragraph 85 of the 2011 ED. And that difference is just related to the nature of the variable consideration. In Paragraph 85, we said that the variable consideration could only vary based upon the customer's subsequent sales. But feedback on the 2011 ED gave an example of a production-based royalty, for example, that has a similar economic pattern as a sales-based royalty. And so the language in Appendix D uses the term of usage-based royalty. So that's a very slight difference between what we propose and paragraph 85 of the 2011 ED. The only other point that I'll make about Appendix D before I open it up to the boards is that there's also a paragraph which is helpfully or unhelpfully labeled 56.3.1 in Appendix D that has some general language about minimum requirements. That language was also in the 2011 ED, and all that language proposes to do is just to acknowledge that in cases aside from licenses, as we've just talked about, that an entity could get to a minimum amount when they're applying the constraint. So I think with that, I'll turn it over to the boards.
Larry? So can you just clarify something for me? Because your recommendation is specific to licensing situations. So if I have a situation where, and maybe this is dealt with returns, I'm not sure. But if I have a situation where I'm a book publisher, and you know, the buyer of the books, this Barnes and Noble or what have you, can return whatever. And there might be some situations where a brand new author, so Bob Hurst and his book, you just don't know how many copies you're going to sell, considering the subject matter.
At least seven.
Or then you could have James Patterson, who, you know, sells out a first printing, a second printing, a third printing, a fourth printing, et cetera. Would your suggestion for the second alternative address that, or would, because right now, I was under the impression, and correct me if I'm wrong, that you would be prohibited, because it's a point-in-time sale, you would be prohibited from recognizing any revenue until, in fact, you got it, which is very bothersome to me because I think you would have to record the cost of sales but yet have no revenue, and I just don't think that that's the right answer, and nor do I think the users probably understood that as a potential when they gave you your feedback. So how would that be dealt with, or would it?
So in option two, it is limited to licenses of intellectual property. So I think in your example, the sale of books is not a license of intellectual property. So what you would do is you would estimate sort of your consideration, but you would be able to recognize a minimum amount. So perhaps you're not sure that you could get 100, which is your estimate, but with something less than that, you could include that minimum amount in the transaction price. But you're right about option one, that because it's a point in time.
Okay. But just to clarify, in option one, though, if you are the James Patterson scenario and you do believe you can come up with an estimate, and when you come out of paragraph 55, that estimate would not be subject to a significant reversal, you would recognize it. It would be the scenario in that you could not do, you come up with your estimate and you can't make the assertion that there's not going to be a reversal, that you would have zero.
Good answer.
But you can always come up with an estimate that won't have a significant reversal. You just continue to go down to the lower level of the estimate.
That's true. That's right. Yeah.
I mean, I sell $1 million worth of books to Pat. I'm pretty sure I'm going to get 10,000.
So I think it depends upon your experience. I mean, who knows how many books Pat's going to sell?
Well, my point is I'm pretty sure when James Patterson sells books, they can come up with a minimum.
Oh, somebody like James Patterson, you could.
But I thought what alternative one was saying was, if you don't have sufficient confidence about the whole, you can't book any.
Right.
For point in time. That's
for
right.
Point in time. So that's why your answer I didn't think was right.
She was answering under alternative two.
Under alternative two.
Right.
Okay.
I started with alternative two. And we finished. Yeah.
Okay.
But Kristen's answer was alternative one.
Correct. That's right. That's correct.
But in a portfolio approach, you can do it. Maybe for James Patterson, you may not be able to do it. But in a portfolio approach, when you have an expected value, you can book it even in point in time if you have a portfolio approach.
But that's not our unit of account.
No, in a portfolio, if you have a portfolio, if it's part of a portfolio and you have an expected value and it is not safe, then you can book it. I don't see a point in time will be a problem under expected value. You guys agree with me or no?
So just to be clear, under alternative one, when I'm selling books with a right of return and I can predict that some of them will not be returned, but I can't with sufficient confidence predict the exact amount. So I've sold $1 million worth of books to Pat Finnegan, who's a bookstore. Okay. I have sufficient confidence at least 100,000 will sell, but it could be between 100,000 and $1 million. Do I book zero or 100,000? Under alternative one, point in time.
What's your estimate?
My estimate is I think in the deal I'm going to sell 800,000, but I have sufficient confidence it won't be less than 100,000.
Zero.
That's what I thought.
Okay. What's alternative two? The 100,000.
100,000.
Right.
Across all. So.
If it's not a license.
The key starting point, it was not a license, so you're not then subject to the new paragraph 85.
Okay. Talk?
Yes. I disagree with option one
because it's quite difficult to distinguish point in time and overtime anyway. And actually, overtime is the series of bunch of consecutive point in time transactions. So I can't find any conceptual basis to distinguish only by the overtime and point in time. So therefore, I disagree with option one. And option two, to some extent, I could live with option two. However, why do we stick to only intellectual property? And in your paragraph 26, you talk about mineral deposit. So the case of mineral deposit is quite similar to the intellectual property. So how would you segregate, and how would you stick to only intellectual property? That is the shortcoming of 85. So in this sense, I think in your paragraph 15, you raised the option which we declined in the board meeting of December. So if we could include this option into consideration, we need to consider it, because it is principle basis. Of course, I know that there is a lot of problem of this option, because it totally depends on your estimates, and you cannot depend on cash transaction, or you cannot depend on the performance obligation. So then there is a danger of structuring. However, coming back to the concept itself, so the option which was described in paragraph 15 could be the most sound way to go forward.
Well, as I said yesterday at the edge session, I think alternative one is creating an unnecessary additional layer of complexity to the model. I think to apply this decision tree in addition to what we already have in the model, it would just confuse people a little bit more. I think alternative two is strong. It is robust. It has clear principles. Two principles: don't book any revenue if you are not certain, and if you have a sufficient degree of comfort, book whatever you can book on which you know you won't have a subsequent reversal, even if that is a portion of the total consideration. We discussed also yesterday, which is paragraph 56.5, the situation that PK explained, the Tom Cruise movie, where you know pretty well after a couple of days how the movie will be successful or not. And here, the exception we make for intellectual property is very, very strong. You don't book any revenue until you know 100% sure. That is when you have evidence of the sales. And my question is whether the last parenthesis in paragraph 56.5, which says, for example, when the customer subsequent sales occur, whether that example is really necessary. If we stop after until the uncertainty is resolved, and there might be different ways to resolve the uncertainty. You see the sales is one way, simplest way, but maybe there are some other elements of objective evidence which will eliminate the uncertainty and which would permit to book some revenue, the amount which you know will not be reversed. I.G. in the case of Tom Cruise movie, after 1 week of showing, you may have some strong evidence that you will have a minimum amount of revenue that you could book. You don't have to need to see the sales. You need to see some other indicators, maybe. So I would just soften a little bit the exception that we make for intellectual property by not specifying what kind of evidence is necessary for the uncertainty to be resolved.
I think it is just sort of a for example. It's just trying to provide a bit of flavor.
Yeah. You know very well that many regulators, maybe enforcement authorities, will use this example as a criteria rather than an example.
Anyone else want to? Tom, you want to get in?
Is there going to be? I think I'm hearing there's three alternatives.
Yeah, I was going to put all three on the table.
Okay. So that's all.
So what I've heard is there's I'm going to say alternative one, alternative two, alternative three. So alternative one is alternative one in the paper, which is that there is a distinction between overtime contract and point-in-time contract. Overtime, you could recognize the minimum. Point-in-time, you could not. That's alternative one. Alternative two, which is also in the paper, is you'd have a different model for the license of intellectual property, which would be based on paragraph 85. You'd recognize revenue when the customer's customer came in versus not intellectual property. That's the CUD. And then alternative three, which was in the paper in paragraph 15 that Talk has raised, is basically the same, and you would always record any amount you have sufficient confidence in, right? So can I get a show of first preferences between alternatives 1, 2, and 3, ISB first.
Well, what's the question?
Because you have to ask
1 or 2 or 3.
1.
I was trying to explain the various alternatives 1, 2, and 3. So now I'm asking for your first preference between alternatives 1, 2, and 3.
Okay. So we vote or
vote? Yes. Both.
So vote. How can we vote?
Now I understand his question. Okay.
Alternative 1.
Who would prefer alternative 1? ISB.
Yeah.
Okay. Alternative 2?
6.
Alternative 3?
6, 7, 8.
How many do you need?
8.
That's
all
we
need.
10
now, right?
No?
10.
Did you get
8?
We need 10?
No, we need the majority. Okay. Just the majority. How many, FASB, how many prefer alternative 1?
We need 1 plus chairman.
Alternative 2, alternative 3, so we have 5 for alternative 3. ISB, do I hear 9, do I hear 10? So you, how many ISB would accept alternative 3?
Wow. 16.
Okay.
For convergence sake.
Sorry, can we just be clear about, because you know we had rejected, and perhaps I want to make sure, similar to our paper that we presented in December, I think the outcome that's in example on page 7 could be a potential, that's the outcome that you prefer when you're voting for, I think, where I just had the majority on both boards, right? That, so in a sales-based license arena, if I have a point-in-time sale and I have a 10-year contract, I'm going to come up with my minimum amount, even if that is $100,000, and then I'm going to keep changing that $100,000 over time until it finally, the end of 10 years, so that I could potentially start with, I couldn't find a minimum, so I'd be 0 for 2 to 3 years.
Yes.
I'd move up to $100,000, and I'd keep moving that number upward, all the way to 10.
I think the reason why Kristen is mentioning this is that we received it, that's the way the 2010 ED worked, and we received a lot of feedback on that, that many people disagreed with that outcome. That's what led us to paragraph 85 in the 2011 ED, and I think even after deleting paragraph 85, but trying to develop these minimum requirements, I think people were still worried that they would end up back in this place. And I think we've had a lot of feedback sort of since that December board meeting about concerns related to that outcome.
Russ,
just wanted to make you aware of that.
Yeah.
I was just going to say, at least for me, and I sense perhaps that others might agree with this, I'm just viewing this option 3 as sort of the lesser of three evils here. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, Larry pointed out some difficulties with option 2, I think it was. No, option 1. And, you know, the paper also pointed out some difficulties with option 2. I think that we're just, there's no perfect answer here. And the true ups that we're seeing with this, while, you know, perhaps it doesn't provide a whole lot of information, at least we're not making an exception for a particular type of transaction. And at least we're not, you know, cutting out this point in time estimate with, say, the book sales. So I just kind of view it as, well, at least it's better than those two.
And it's consistent with the treatment of, for point in time for variable consideration that's viewed to be a concession when it has to do with impairment.
PK? I think I want to build on what Christine and Allison mentioned. The reason is that whilst option three is consistent with the model, we need to think about two aspects, because I have a fear that this issue will come back. I'm just telling you that people who are hearing this message right now, this vote, are going to send the emails and the phone calls, because this has been rejected by both the preparers and the users of the financial statements, because they felt that they have no... what they said was, if I remember correctly, and help me if I mistake it, I agree that the amount of revenue to be recognized should be closer to the, at the same time when the performance obligation is performed. But in certain situations, it is not possible. So what they said is, in those circumstances, any subsequent true-ups does not reflect the performance obligation that has been performed. And they felt that they will not get any traction. And for example, I'll take you I'll use a better medical term, medicine. Let's say that is Prozac, and it is a 10-year patent. So I have a good estimation. I will not have a good estimation for the first 7 years. So at the end of the seventh year, I have a good estimation. So I book the entire amount at the end of the seventh year. But has the seventh year estimation true up has no relation to the performance obligation performed in year seven. So what they said was, in those circumstances, it's better to have cash as the approximation or a proxy to do that. And I agree that doesn't make sense from the model point of view, but both the users and the preparers are comfortable with that. I think this vote of ours is going to be a seismic change, and a lot of the health, the pharmaceuticals, the people who are in the royalty business, are going to be really up in the arms and say that our models are going to completely get blown out. So be aware of that. And I just feel that we will be sitting each other and looking at September again. So I would suggest to the staff or to the boards that perhaps if that doesn't, three does not work because of the feedback we are going to get.
PK, can I play devil's advocate and ask you a question?
Yes.
You're the CFO of that company that now is launching this drug. Who is putting a gun to your head, forcing you to recognize revenue? No. You're forcing them to go through an analysis to determine whether or not there's a level of uncertainty and whether or not, you know, it's great enough to say it's subject to significant reversal.
We are requiring them to book a minimum. We are requiring them to estimate.
Hang on. If you sell Prozac...
But if you reach the point where you think the level of uncertainty is too great, you don't book it.
You book at least a dollar, though.
You have to book something. You are forced to estimate. By this vote, you are forced to estimate.
It would be
book every time.
Hold on. Part of the concern, I think, was, and back to the book example, okay, I sell books to Pat Finnegan, hard books, these things. I get one answer, then if I sell them the content on here.
Yeah.
And is that really the answer we wanted? Do we want to have, in an electronic world, a different philosophy when you can throw it and kick it versus when you cannot? And that was part of the problem. So if we say we want to have a similar model for all transactions, which was the inherent philosophy in all of revenue, we have to take a choice. Now, what we could say, which was embedded within option one, was all point in time, you book zero, which will be a significant change for the people that sell books. Or we could have said, no, it's aligned, and then it's a significant change for people that sell licenses. So that's really the, as Daryl put it, appropriate. The best of two evils. Mary?
I
forgot what he said. There you go.
But close. That's
looking at paragraph 15 in the example that we were pointed to by the staff after the vote, the staff has a comment at the end saying, this points out the concern about the usefulness of the information about revisions of estimates as being reported as current period revenue. I think we should think about whether there's a disclosure that we should be pointing to for entities that have significant amounts of these revisions of estimates, separating out revenue that's recognized from transactions in the period versus revisions of estimates for transactions in previous periods, because that would seem to go some way to addressing the concern that the staff identified with this outcome in example 15, paragraph 15.
Is that by chance an existing disclosure we have for variable consideration?
Yeah.
This sounds right, yeah. That may already be a...
Then I don't understand the concern. Then I think the concern may be overstated that's expressed in the end of this example.
Agreed. Do you...
I think there's two...
feedback we heard from those constituents that would express it that way.
There are two issues that caused me to go for the third view. One is people are saying it's inconsistent with the model. I disagree. There's been performance under the model here that we've constrained recognizing revenue because of variable consideration. Once the variable consideration is resolved, we're not going to be recognizing anything based on performance. It's done. But why would we say once variable consideration is resolved, you got to wait till there's cash? I don't agree with that. That's not consistent with the model to me. And second of all, this exception on sales-based royalties isn't a broad exception for sale-based royalties. It's only that in intellectual property contracts. I don't understand why that remotely makes sense. It's I could argue sales-based royalties, all of them, but I don't even buy into that because there's a lot of other comparative sort of circumstances where there is underlying estimates that are uncertain.
I agree with you on the sales-based royalty, but I think the issue is that customers' estimation becomes a very difficult game to play. If you look at the price concession, if you look at the credit, it's one-on-one. But here, it is your customer. I sell it to you, your customer. The visibility into the pipeline becomes very difficult.
And well, there should be sufficient uncertainty about it that it's zero.
Yeah, but exactly. You will not be able to book zero. Trust me.
Who is going to force in the book?
I am going to force it as an auditor. I'm going to force it as a regulator.
No, you're not.
Yes, I am.
It is subject to the constraint, okay? And you have to get to a fairly high hurdle in order to get past that constraint. That's why we put it in.
Where in the constraint it stops, Larry?
I think it's a fair point. I think... You know, it's going to be hard to assert that you can't come up with some minimum level, which you can't say that there's... And I'm just torn on this because I hear all your comments, I hear what you say. I mean, and I understand your unease with either option one and option two and why you prefer to go with the principle. PK's point is fair too, I think, and I think it's right that it just got raised again because you effectively created paragraph 85, you exposed it, and so you sort of said to people, we heard the concern on the first CD, we agree with you, we put it in. Now, obviously, we can change our decision, but you just need to be aware that you gave basically these people, for want of a word, a safe harbour, and now you're sort of saying, no, you are going to get the outcome that you would have got under the first ED. So you just need to be aware.
But in the second ED, we didn't have the constraint in place, did we?
Yeah, reasonably assured. Yeah.
I'm sorry, but that reasonably assured is very different than the constraint we have right now that we've deliberated. So very different.
I tried to link our decision on leasing, variable lease payment. I particularly want to ask a question to PK because we joined dissent, but not dissent on the variable lease payment part. On the variable lease payment part, it seems you want to recognize more. Why here you want to recognize nothing?
That's a liability, this is a revenue.
That's the honest to God truth. The other side.
I'm more interested in the lessee side on the variable consideration, and I said very clearly it is a liability. I need to reflect the liability correctly. Same in the business combination. You've got to recognize the liability.
So anybody based on this discussion the last 15 minutes change their mind about alternative three?
No. I am extremely nervous that this will come back and we will be sitting here in September and October discussing
this. Which is fair, but
we are rehashing.
December, January.
I know, but... and the post-implementation review? Sure.
Okay, so...
Good reason to be very nervous.
So, everyone comfortable where we are on terminal three and we go on the next memo? Okay. So next memo.
And Brian over in Norwalk.
Good luck, Steph.
Okay, so this is paper 7B173B.
First, I want to make sure you can hear me. Am I coming through okay? Okay. So this paper considers the accounting for contracts that cannot qualify to apply the revenue model because they don't meet the criteria in paragraph 14 of the standard. The staff had received questions from board members and constituents about the accounting for these contracts, and this paper represents our attempt to address those concerns. Appendix A of the paper presents paragraphs 14.1 through 14.3 of the staff draft, which would apply when consideration has been received, but the contract fails the criteria in paragraph 14. So under that guidance, the consideration received would be recognized as revenue only if both of the following conditions are met. The entity has no remaining obligations to transfer goods or services to the customer, and the consideration is non-refundable. If both of those conditions are met, the entity would derecognize the transferred asset and recognize a restricted asset, the same carrying amount as that transferred asset, and subsequently would be reduced by receipts of non-refundable consideration. And this would defer any profit on that sale until the entity's cost basis is recovered. And if the two conditions are not met, then consideration received is recorded as a liability, and the asset is not derecognized. Now, we did receive a fair amount of feedback on this. Some were supportive of including guidance for what to do with the transaction that fails paragraph 14. We did hear some concerns, though, about, you know, why are we including guidance for transactions that fail step one of the model? Why are we including asset derecognition guidance, including a few specific concerns, including what would be the nature of the restricted asset and what impairment model would apply? The P&L impact would be zero until the profit impact would be zero until the cost basis is recovered, whereas if you passed 14 and you had to derecognize the asset but the variable consideration is constrained, you might have a loss in an early period under our model. And finally, the timing of reassessment and when you would actually transition into the model. So the paper presents two alternatives. Alternative one is to maintain paragraphs 14.1 to 14.3 of the staff draft with some clarifications, and these are in Appendix A. Alternative two would prohibit revenue recognition until the contract is essentially complete, canceled, or a reassessment of paragraph 14 indicates that you have passed step one. Under this alternative, the revenue standard would be silent on asset derecognition, and we would rely on existing U.S. GAAP and IFRS. And the FASB would likely need to clarify in its consequential amendments under Topics 350 and 360 that on the sale of a non-financial asset, if you fail the criteria in paragraph 14 of the revenue topic, then you would not derecognize these assets. So a key consideration is whether the boards think that revenue should be recognized when a non-refundable down payment or installment payment is made, or if the boards think that revenue should be precluded until the transaction is essentially complete. There's only one question in the paper. It's on page 10, and it is whether the boards agree that the final revenue standard should provide guidance for entities to apply when a contract does not meet the criteria in paragraph 14, but that guidance should be limited to addressing revenue recognition, meaning it would not address cost derecognition. So with that, I'll turn it over to you.
Any thoughts? Questions?
Agree with the staff.
So who, FASB first, who agrees with the staff recommendation, which is in paragraph 24 of the memo? Oh, well, Stephen's voting for Mark, I guess.
I see.
When Mark comes back, we'll ask him officially what his view is. I'm going to go real slow. ISB?
Other
is the staff recommendation? Okay.
Mark.
There was no debate. The question is, do you agree with the staff recommendation?
Yes.
Okay, so we're unanimous. Six. Okay. Right.
Six.
Anything else?
Four, eight.
Okay. A big damage. Nothing else? Okay. Yeah.
Yes, this to the end of the joint board meeting. We will continue at 3 o'clock. Wish the FSB and staff safe trip.
Yes.
Thanks, guys.